Thank you very much for tuning in to Scenes of Violence here on Fire Engineering's Blog Talk Radio. I am Steve Hamilton. I will be your host for this evening. And we have two very special guests and a very important event that we're going to be talking about that's coming up here at the end of the month. But let me introduce my first guest, Mr. Dealers, or Captain DiLorenzo. Are you on?
I am here, sir.
So we have Captain DiLorenzo on. He is from Myrtle Beach Police Department, and he has done some pretty dynamic and interesting things regarding recovery to active shooter, hostile event, stressful circumstances and responses involving responders. And we're going to dive into that here into some detail and talk about some program stuff that's been going on. But Captain, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself a little bit, make yourself familiar with everybody.
Sure. So Eric DiLorenzo, I'm currently a captain with the City of Myrtle Beach Police in South Carolina. Been on the force for about 24 years. Currently, I oversee our training units, all of our specialized teams, SWAT negotiations, mobile field force, do all of our emergency management planning to include special event planning, and liaison with our city's emergency management director. So FBI NA grad, session 268, also got my master's degree from Georgetown University, which is what prompted the research that I conducted while in that program that led me to being on the talk today. Got a long background in different aspects of active shooter, and that stemmed from my work that I was a school resource officer back in 1999. That really, I jumped into the fire, if you will, with active shooter coming to be the first school resource officer in my city right at the aftermath of Columbine. So have been involved in active shooter to some degree, planning and training and mitigation since that time. And that's enough about me, so I'll turn it back over to you.
I love Myrtle Beach. And for those that are unfamiliar with the geography of the state, I am in Columbia, which is not that far from Myrtle Beach, about 2.5-3 hours, give or take, depending on which road you're going to take. And super, super glad that you were able to hop on the show tonight, and I appreciate your presence and the stuff we're going to talk about. So thank you for that. And also on the line, we have John Curtnut, who is the Assistant Director of Alert. John, do I still got you?
Yes, sir, I'm still here.
So, again, as Eric did, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and familiarizing the listeners with who you are and what you do?
Yes, sir. Yeah, so right out of high school, joined the Army, infantry. After that, went to Texas State University. Back then it was Southwest Texas State University for criminal justice. Got hired on with the San Marcos Police Department in 1995 and worked there full-time for 21 years. 18 of those years, I was on the SWAT team. I was also an SRO for a few years. I was 1999 as well when we were watching Columbine happen. I was actually at an ATF gang conference in Dallas when that went down. I retired in 2016. I was about to go back to my agency and start promoting because I was on loan for a period of time from my agency to the alert program, myself and David Burns of Hays County Sheriff's Office and Terry Nichols with the San Marcos Police Department at the time. We'd put this alert program together, and we're training people in the county and then in our region and then statewide, and then it became national after 9/11. With the grants that we get, we put the training on. It's free to the end user and the agencies. So I was on loan with that program for a number of years, and in 2016, when I was about to go back to my agency to start promoting, I was given an offer I couldn't refuse to retire from the city and go work for Texas State University and stay on the program that I love. So I'm the assistant director there, and for the last 5 years, I've also been a reserve officer. Still stay active in training, still see a lot going on and try to participate in as much as I can, but more in an administrative role now. I oversee our IT, our training divisions, e-learning divisions, logistics, just try to stay on top of all that.
Crazy computer stuff that hurts my head when I try to think about it.
Yeah, they gave me an extra screen, so I'm two-screening it. Maybe I'll go to a third screen next year. I'm thinking about it.
Let me know how that goes. I have two screens, and I'm still trying to figure that out myself. So to familiarize folks, because we're talking about alert, and that's advanced law enforcement, rapid response training. Can you expand on alert a little bit, and more poignantly, especially in the last several years, you guys have also kind of shifted the focus from advanced law enforcement, rapid response training, and you're also including fire and EMS in some of the modalities and the ideologies that you guys are teaching, right?
Yes, sir. So we started off as law enforcement because right after Columbine, we were trying to, you know, change the culture of first response to these active attacks. So that's where we started. Being attached to Texas State University, there's a very robust research component to it. So as we researched the events and how they were going down and timelines and response and any deficiencies or gaps that we identified in the analysis of the, you know, after actions and stuff like that, we started to notice some gaps. So we would address those gaps with curriculum development. The tactics, not so much the concepts and principles of trying to solve problems. You know, we've encountered a lot of things over the years, but one of the overriding themes of our program is concepts and principles. We'll talk tactics all day long, but, you know, tactics are very preferential and individualistic. Concepts and principles are kind of the overarching. We kind of subscribe to the whole patent theory of don't try to make the circumstances fit your plans. Make plans that fit the circumstances, right? So the research kind of led us down the road of expanding just off of law enforcement and getting into civilian response. So we started teaching Avoid, Deny, Defend, which has become Run, Hide, Fight. When the city of Houston created the Run, Hide, Fight video, they were basically using our curriculum and some of our instructors in the city of Houston to make that video, and then they retitled it Run, Hide, Fight. But we're all basically saying the same thing. You know, when seconds count and we're minutes away and still on the phone, what can you do to protect yourself and defend yourself? So then we got into, you know, the medical needs for law enforcement. We need to know tourniquets and the TCC, TECC medicine that we teach. So, you know, bandaging, occlusive dressings on, you know, penetrating trauma to the chest. We started teaching that to cops, but we realized, you know, we really need to get the medical professionals, people that are better at this than we are. We need to get them in there. That's their primary role. So how do we do that? And we just started looking at what other people were doing out there in Arlington, Virginia. Obviously, they have the Rescue Task Force. So we looked at that. We looked at other ways that sometimes it wasn't by design. It was by accident or by circumstance. Scooping people up and throwing them in the back of a cop car was not popular. It's effective, but it can also be detrimental. So we started looking at ways that we could do that better if that's the only option that's on the table, CCPs. And then we started looking at, you know, a recurring theme over the years was incident command or lack thereof. We don't utilize it in law enforcement enough to really understand it. And so we had to learn it, and we also had to, you know, get people that knew it really well how to understand that we're going to build it a little bit differently. So the whole, you know, command, control, communication piece, establishing command early on, growing it as time and resources arrive on scene, stop the killing, stop the dying, CAS-EVAC very quickly, very, very quickly to definitive care. Those are kind of the big overarching goals, and within each one of those is a myriad of tactics and choices that you can make, all situationally, locationally, and asset and time dependent.
So essentially, the programs that you offer in summation is preparation to left or right a bang when that finally kicks off. So we're talking,
yes, sir,
preparing and responding.
Yes, civilian response, and then law enforcement's initial response, and then transitioning into unifying command and staging and bringing in fire and police, or fire and EMS and police assets, bring them in, you know, by design. And the communication piece is also very, very much involved with telecommunicators, so our dispatchers. I mean, they're the ones that get the call before anybody else. They're the ones that are feeding the information as it's fed to them. They're trying to make sense of all the radio traffic, patch people together. We're always in training where we're like, oh, we'll just get dispatch to do that. We'll just get dispatch to do that. And very few people understand that dispatch centers are melting with the number of calls going in and out, and they don't have the staffing for that surge capacity that's in, you know, inevitably going to happen. So there's just this, everyone's been looking at this for the last 20 years in their different respective silos, and we're trying to integrate and create a more holistic approach. All stakeholders need to be involved in this. They need to see from their respective altitudes and angles how this problem needs to be attacked and how we can work with each other in concert with each other and not get in each other's way.
And I'm glad you brought up a couple of really good points in that. One of them being telecommunications. Captain O'Shaughnessy was on here a year and a half, 2 years ago, and we discussed the Route 91 shooting. And that was very much a response-oriented conversation from the standpoint of fire. And when you look at the FEMA after-action report of that, telecommunicators got slammed. I mean, horrifically, yeah, bad. When you look at the analytics of that, like 1,500 calls holding, waiting for a telecommunicator to answer it, process the information, and send resources if needed for 3 hours straight.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
more telecommunicators came in off duty to help those on duty than were actually on duty. It's a crazy aspect of the things that we do day to day. And we all rag on dispatchers. If you haven't ragged on a dispatcher, you probably haven't been working in emergency services all that long. We all rag on dispatchers a little bit, but at the end of the day, we can't operate without them. And
absolutely,
I think that's a great point in the fact that that has been a lost component in this chain necessary to get from one end to the other.
Yeah, they're a link in the chain and a very crucial one. And we've all made this assumption that they just know what to do, but they don't get the training. We're not inviting them to our training to see what we're doing so that they can understand what it means when they hear this stuff over the radio. So, yeah, it's just an integration issue that is getting fixed.
And so we got the preparation and the response, and switching gears a little bit, going over to Cap DiLorenzo. Captain, you have a third aspect of this, and that's the recovery part. Where are you at with the recovery part to this dynamic event that we have focused a great deal on preparation and responding to, and maybe in the emergency services world haven't really focused on recovery all that much?
Sure. So, I have come from this with an aspect from being a longtime peer support team member for the South Carolina Law Enforcement Assistance Program, which is a statewide peer support team here in South Carolina. And officer wellness, officer resiliency, peer support, taking care of my brother and sister officers is something that I'm very, very passionate about. And people that know me know that's something that is really very near and dear to my heart. Having gone through, you know, critical incidents and traumatic incidents and line of duty deaths and just all kinds of bad things through my career personally, and seeing the effects that it had on me and a lot of my brothers and sisters in law enforcement and the fire service and in EMS, you know, I've always said to myself, you know, ALERT does amazing work on teaching what to do, how to respond, how to evacuate the casualties, how to mitigate things. You know, they do a great job, but where kind of I always thought there was a gap was what do we do after we pull away from the curb and we head back to the station, whether it's the fire department, EMS, or police, what do we do when we go back to the station and we've just been through hell on earth? How do we recover from that? How do we stay resilient? How do we go to the next call? How do we work the next shift? And it's, you know, how do we deal with the second disaster? How do we keep our emergency services going? How do we keep our workforce healthy and well? And that's kind of the area that I've always wanted to do further research in. And, you know, what I teach and what I train is that you have the first incident, which is the event, the act of violence, whether it's, you know, an active shooter, other mass casualty type event. But the second disaster is how you handle those responders and how you deal with a grieving community and how you deal with all of the other things that come in after an incident that we haven't planned for. And it could be everything from mass donations to just all kinds of things that we never really trained for, we never really prepared for. But if not handled correctly, it will ruin a chief's career. It will end their career because you will have a lack of confidence from your community, from your officers. And if not handled properly, it's absolutely the second disaster, and it doesn't need to be at all. So ALERT has brought some subject matter experts together to create a framework and a plan kind of moving forward. What's great about that is ALERT has the name. They have the history of great training throughout the world. So I think some great things are going to come of this in the future.
Well, that's excellent transition into why are you both here this evening? Because one could listen in and be like, these are drastically different aspects, but there's a bridge. And outside of some project stuff, which we'll dive into here in a second, we got something coming up at the end of the month where the both of you are integrated into that. And I'd like to start with John, what's going on at the end of the month that ALERT's got going on?
So at the end of the month, we'll have our annual conference, and our conference is quite unique. So I alluded to the grant funds that were awarded both through the COPS Office, Department of Justice, and also through our state of Texas legislative line item appropriations. And we also have some other funding sources that come in through the way of grants. And those grants are very unique in that they allow us to offset all the operational costs for us to go out and deliver training, to also bring equipment and certify instructors to be able to train their people once we leave. Any type of logistical back-end support, we build that into our budget. But the legislative language in those grants is very particular on who we can touch and how much we can do with them. So the conference is unique because it's self-funded, so it allows us to kind of expand the left and right boundaries. And now we have first responders, emergency management, community leaders, school administrators, hospital staffs, physicians, I mean, you name it. We have survivors from attacks. We have people that have started, you know, programs like I Love You Guys in SRP, Standard Response Protocol. We have all these stakeholders that are looking at it from all these different angles. And so at our conference, we get to bring everyone together and look at all angles, all altitudes, left of bang, during the bang, right of bang, and we're really starting to push the recovery and the resiliency. But we also know that that's directly tied to, you know, selection, training, and everything that leads up to the event will set you up to kind of better bounce forward from the event. So that's going to be Saturday, October 30th through Tuesday, November 2nd, and it's at Gaylord Opryland in Nashville, Tennessee. Incredible speakers, incredible networking capabilities, and just an amazing time to kind of bring all this together in one location.
And in that, NFPA 3000 has been a topic of conversation on here for a long time. It's a little known secret that I'm on the technical committee for that. And the motto or the concept behind 3000's implementation is a community-based integration and bringing stakeholders to include law enforcement, identifying them as a stakeholder, fire and EMS, identifying them as a stakeholder, and then the businesses in the community that are affected by or are targeted by these types of acts. It's
sure.
The model being plan, respond, and recover. And what you just went through is, as far as articulating the conferences, participants is those who are responsible for planning, preparing, and recovering, which is, well, it's not a concept borrowed from one or another. It just makes sense. It's
absolutely.
You're covering all three aspects that you need in order to, as a community, deal with something like this when it happens. And it's going to happen. It's not a question of if, it's more of a question of when.
Sure. And we've had speakers in the past talk about, you know, the shootings in Las Vegas and surge capacity in the emergency rooms and ICUs that was well beyond what they were capable of. And how did they make that work? I mean, so this didn't go according to plan, but this is what it is. So we've heard innovation and, you know, people making lemonade out of the lemons that were handed to them. We'll hear about stuff like that. And this goes to engaging, you know, hospital staff and physicians, organizations. It goes into blood banks and people that, you know, lab technicians and people that manage. And it will impact everyone at some point. And when we talk about recovery, all right, so who's coming to the scene? Who's going to start dealing with the critical incident stress management and debriefs? Are these trauma-informed care, you know, counselors, are they, you know, we talked about this at our summit that we hosted. People say, yeah, well, we have an EAP, you know, so we have some EAP counselors on standby. Man, this is not, you know, I think my kid's doing drugs or, you know, my wife and I are having a hard time. We may be going through divorce. This is a different type of trauma, and you need some people that really understand what these people have gone through so that they can kind of, you know, not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you. And so we're inviting everyone that could look at this from any angle or any altitude to come and see what is going on and what part they're going to play in this.
And having said that, Captain, you are presenting at this conference, correct?
Yes, I'll be presenting at the conference this year.
And what is your class? And give us kind of a little bit of a synopsis and when you're going to be presenting.
Sure. So I'm going to be presenting on particularly after it happens is the name of it. So talking about the impacts on officers that have responded to active shooter events. So giving an understanding of what exactly happens to the officer from an emotional standpoint. And then really how to build a framework or develop that capacity to quickly recover. Really the part that I speak about is managing the emotion afterwards. Because again, as I said earlier, that's really to me the second disaster. If it's not handled properly, you know, our police officers, our firefighters, our EMTs really are a precious commodity. and we have to treat them as such. So, you know, you'll see in my presentation where I talk about, you know, every department has a line item for maintenance of their vehicles. Very, very few departments have a line item for the maintenance of their employee. And to John's point, you know, one of the things I talk about all the time is EAP doesn't work for cops, firefighters, and medics. They don't understand our culture 9 times out of 10. There's some great people out there with EAP, but I have literally seen more harm done than good from EAP counselors a lot of times. When we talk specifically about those that critical incident trauma, you know, they may have a little bit of training in trauma, but do they really understand our culture? Do they really understand what we've gone through? EAP absolutely positively has a place in our culture and in our departments and in our community. But when it comes to this really heavy traumatic stuff, you know, I don't always know that they're the best served. So one of the things I talk about is, you know, seeking out that vetted mental health. I know from experience that after these critical incidents, do-gooders will show up and say, hey, I'm a trauma counselor. And you know, I was at 9/11. I always hear they're from 9/11. I was here, I was there, and they come up with a brochure and a business card and say, hey, I'm here to help your employee, whether it's a cop, a firefighter, whatever. And then find out that really they're just there to either find out about what happened with the incident. They may have a good heart, but they're in over their head. And no police officer, speaking as a cop myself, is going to talk to a stranger. It's a whole lot different when you have somebody who is vetted, who is trusted, who may have been introduced to your department ahead of time that other officers can vouch for. That is invaluable when you get to the recovery aspect of it. It's like the old adage, you don't want to hand out business cards and learn who each other are at the scene. You want to learn who you are ahead of time. It's no different for mental health professionals. And really what I talk about is really developing that into your culture, where you have trusted people that you can bring in, because you can't do this all yourself. No agency is able to handle this on their own, nor should they, because sometimes an outside perspective is exactly what you need, because when you're immersed in that incident, sometimes you can't see the forest through the trees. So talking about, you know, vetted mental health, coming up with a recovery framework to help make sure that everything is being taken care of and everything's being addressed. And really, you know, we have no problem bringing in outside resources to the scene, right? Another SWAT team shows up, other, you know, fire departments show up, but are you prepared for the recovery to bring in other resources to help you with security details, funeral escorts? You know, I've been to some chaotic scenes where we've literally brought in officers from surrounding jurisdictions just to ride with officers from that agency, because you know their head is not in the game that night. So have chiefs, have sheriffs thought about that? And the answer is usually not. Typically what I find for my presentation is I get this look of, oh my goodness, I've never really thought about all of that. And that's why ALERT is so powerful, because they are going to expose people to it, and they have the experts right there at the conference to bring it all together. And that's what's really cool about what ALERT is doing, and the conference in particular.
Well, I think it's timely that you mention it, because a lot of experience from my perspective for the last 20 years about active shooter has always been about the response. And we seek subject matter experts, and these subject matter experts have lots of initials after their names. They've done a lot of research. They may have real life experiences being a responder at an incident. And as you already articulated it, when you try to find a clinician to cover the mental health aspect, we seem to fall short in that aspect. And we do these drills and exercises, and active shooter at the school, and it's all been set up for months, and we send fire and law enforcement, EMS, and they go in and they neutralize the bad people, and we pick up the mannequins or bodies and carry them to the colored tarps, and they transport them to the hospital, and everybody checks these boxes that we've practiced this, and then we say we're done, and we haven't covered the biggest part of that for us as responders, and that is, what do you do when you get off shift and go home? How do you process that? And that process, having gone through that process, that can get really, really lonely, really, really fast, and it can affect you in a horrific way. So I think it's great that you're pouring your energies and efforts into that aspect of it.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's timely also because, you know, we've been focusing on acute trauma, like you had a really bad event, and now what do you do afterwards? How do you unpack that? You know, how do you figure out what the new familiar is going to be? How do you just carry on with the mission? But there's another problem, and we're seeing this the last 18 months, I think, has been very pronounced, is this chronic trauma, or the aggregate, or the collection of all the stuff that happens just over a period of time of being exposed. I think you're seeing some cracks and fissures appear in our foundation of our professions in being able to handle this. We've got to get ahead of this. We've got to catch up, and we've got to keep up, and then we've got to get ahead of this.
Well, I think over the years, we've, as a service, we've probably done better in it being okay to say, hey, I'm not dealing with this real well right now, where your peers or your fellow officers, firefighters, medics, they're not looking at you like you're less than, or that you're mentally disabled, or come on, man, buck up, hike your boots up, let's go, cry tomorrow, we got work to do. I think culturally we've kind of transitioned away from that a little bit.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think it's like anything else. We, you know, it was like active shooter training in the very beginning. You know, I didn't sign up for this. That's not what I do. And eventually we've eased into that, and then we get into, you know, tourniquets in the hands of cops. No. And it's like, you know, two things that everyone hates is the way things are and change. But we have to. We have to evolve. We're constantly learning and progressing and evolving. And this is the thing that needs to be addressed finally, and that is, you know, both chronic and acute trauma throughout our careers. And there's got to be some intervention, and I like the way that, you know, Captain DeLorenzo's preventive maintenance. I mean, it's just like anything else. You're going to get worn out, but you can't get worn out. We cannot allow you to break in mid-call or in mid-task. Just like we can't afford a plane to break at 40,000 feet, you can't break on this call.
And Captain, you did, you know, higher education theses on these. What is your research pulled out of that as far as that aspect? Where do you think we are?
So to John's point, I mean, he hit the nail on the head. We have to catch up. We have to, you know, and it's kind of foreign to me being from South Carolina, where peer support is very heavily embedded, but that is not the norm across the nation. You know, so I do think the culture has to change, and strides are being made very, very rapidly, but we're still playing catch up on those efforts. But I will tell you, you know, from my department in particular, officers talk. Officers don't bottle it up anymore. There is no, you know, suck it up, it's part of the job. You know, guys are looking out for each other. And really, you know, what part of the audience that a lot of times I'm talking to are the executives, and I'm saying you have got to make sure that you are treating your officers as a commodity, just like you know, chiefs and sheriffs will lose their mind if somebody goes out and cracks up a police car. But if they have an officer that's banged up, it's just like, oh, okay, well, just what's the deal? Get them back to work. We're pouring money into all these other things. We've got to pour money into keeping our officers well, because they really, really are a precious commodity. And that is changing. Talking specifically about the research that I did, basically it's finds out that all the officers that my study examined had high levels of post-traumatic stress. My data was gleaned from de-identified data that was gathered at the post-critical incident seminar, which is a seminar held in South Carolina and many other states. I think there's probably close to maybe 9 or 10 other states that have the post-critical incident seminar. And officers that identified that they were there because of having responded to an active shooter event, I was able to study their impact of event scale, which is a scale that's used by mental health professionals to basically determine how much post-traumatic stress that they may be exhibiting. And I was able to show that officers who fill this out are leaps and bounds above other officers. Probably the most traumatic event other than, suicide of a child or something like that, or, you know, just some really other crazy events. The officers that responded to active shooter events were very, very high in showing signs of, impact signs of post-traumatic stress. So in a nutshell, that's what my research showed. I don't think that's shocking to anybody, but to have concrete data supporting that, I found has been very, very powerful. John mentioned about how officers can't crack up on a call. Like, that's just not feasible in our line of business. And that goes for fire and EMS too. But, you know, you talk about intrusive thoughts and hyperarousal and avoidance issues. The officers that I studied were leaps and bounds above any of the other critical incidents that were presented at that seminar. So post-critical incident seminar is a 3-day seminar that officers and we've even had fire and EMS at the table as well, where they talk about their incident, why they're there, kind of what they've been going through. They do some small group work, some one-on-one work. There's experts from across the nation doing different interventions such as EMDR, everything from massage to, you know, really just taking care of our officers for 3 days, and the impact that it has on these officers. We are literally saving lives and saving careers and saving marriages. It's by far the most impactful thing I've ever been to. And any chance I get to be a peer at one of those, I'm honored and happy to do it. So that was kind of my where I had access to that data, and I wanted to leverage it, and I found that it really, really has gotten the attention of a lot of people.
Well, and I think it speaks towards what you've said about agencies and agencies progressing. As an example, the Richland County Sheriff's Department, I have seen an officer-involved shooting situation where, you know, you got to take your firearm because, you know, it's evidence now. And I've watched the sheriff who showed up at the scene take his weapon out of his holster and hand it to the deputy whose weapon was just taken for evidence so that he's not weaponless, so he doesn't feel like he's been punished or that we're going to take this from you, and now he feels stripped of self. So I think it's great that there's agencies like that are progressive in thinking in the mental aspect of things, and not just we go to this incident, we mitigate it and gather what we need to gather to bring people to justice, gather what we need to gather to prevent future fire incidents or dramatic medical calls that resulted in some type of mass casualty from an intentional or unintentional act, and it's not just show up, do your thing, go home, do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, and I have worked with Richland County, and as you're well aware, they have had no shortage of critical and traumatic events. You know, and I know they have a very robust peer team. I've had the unfortunate pleasure of working with them at many different times, and, you know, they are an agency that is very progressive, and they get it. And like you said, the dividends that, you know, Sheriff Lott just being able to do that for one of his officers is hugely impactful. But, you know, how many other law enforcement leaders would think like that? The answer is, unfortunately, far too few. And really what is I have noticed more often than not is chiefs, sheriffs, captains, majors, whatever, they're trying to do the right thing. They just don't have the training. They just don't have the experience. So they're doing what they think is best. But in the meantime, they're doing more harm than good. And it's not out of malice. It's not out of not caring. It's out of not knowing. And I think that's where ALERT is absolutely going to leverage some excellent training in the future to, you know, make the next generation of leaders and current leaders that much better.
And exactly. You have to be a student of your profession. It doesn't matter what your profession is. You could be law enforcement, fire, a basket weaver. It doesn't matter. You must be a student of your profession. And the moment you have lost the vigor and learning, it's probably time to switch your profession or just hang it up and call it a day. And I think that ALERT has brought knowledge, education, and not just classes being taught by people, but analytics, statistics, best practices, honed and vetted as part of a program package to say this is where you need to be. And that's speaking out of turn, but you guys are working right now with Captain, aren't you, John, for developing programs and some training or something of that nature along the lines of his expertise?
Yes, everything just fits hand in glove with each other. You just can't continue to only talk about tactics and strategy and not address the foundation upon which everything is going to be built, which is the mental, emotional, spiritual, physical, tactical health of the individual that you're going to build this off of. It's not going to work the way you want it to work if they're not in a good headspace. So it has to be addressed. We're going to do the best we can to kind of fit it within our current scope of work and expand that scope of work as time goes on. Reach out. I mean, we're all about bridge building, so we're constantly reaching out to people that they do this more than we do, but we want to know what they know because there's an aspect of it that we can weave into our curriculum, and we will because it is important.
Well, what we're capturing is what's important to our community. And if you go in the order of operation, what's most important is when somebody calls 911, a professional representative of state and local government is going to show up to your problem, and they're going to fix your problem. And that's the most important thing from a community standpoint when they're looking at something that has become a trend or a norm. Very little thought is then transferred to, well, how do I make sure that when I call 911 that the people show up are professional and that they are prepared to deal with whatever my problem is and the next problem and the next problem and the next problem of the other people, because it does take a toll. There's a reason why you for your service label, it exists for a reason. The people who are thanking you have most likely had some type of experience interacting with your agency or profession, and the sight of you reminds them of it, and they just want to take a moment to thank you. So turning the tables towards those individuals being prepared to respond, not just at the task or tactical level, or even the strategical level of resources, but how do I maintain the health and safety of my resources tomorrow? And I think it's great that you guys are looking at that aspect, because it's a real thing and it's important. And without it, if you can't get on the truck, you can't answer the radio call, you can't get in the bus or the car, then we're gonna have a much bigger problem over the aggregate that is gonna catch up to us and really, really kick us pretty hard.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been talking and focusing on the performance aspect of this, job performance and when it really counts. But, I mean, your personal life is going to suffer if you don't get a handle on this. You're not going to have much of one. And that's going to just exacerbate the problem. And then we're all working towards something, and we should be. And that's, you know, hopefully one day to hang it up and retire, pass the baton on to somebody else. And you want to walk out of there and you want to outlive the mortality tables on your pension system. I mean, you've earned it. But you're not going to make it if you don't take care of yourself mentally, emotionally, physically, health-wise. It's a package deal. It has to happen.
So, Captain, outside of the obvious preparation for the conference, what aspect of that are you most looking forward to aside from spreading knowledge and trying to express what you're looking to put out there?
Sure. I mean, the conference, although it has amazing speakers, and I don't say that lightly, it really does. What I really enjoy about that conference is it's people from all different walks of life, in all different backgrounds and all different kinds of professions. So you have me, a police captain, you have a fire chief, you have EMS, but then you have the school superintendent, you have the mental health professional, you have the trauma surgeon, and really bringing everybody together. And it's like John mentioned, I mean, it all comes together. But that alert conference, you really get to hear everybody's different side. And then I know for me, I was sitting in a lecture and I was like, wow, okay, I get it now. This makes sense. I see why everybody's together. I see why having the school principal here is so important, because the way they look at it is totally different than the way I look at it. But we've never had that conversation, you know, and really – that was really, really powerful to me the first time I was at the conference, and I was like, all right, I get it. This makes sense. And the networking really is great. I mean, I've made friends at that conference that I can pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm working on this. Can you share this with me? Or I know you're working on this. Can you share your plan with me? As we know, the leader that has the better network has the easier day at work when they're not reinventing the wheel. And that's really, those networking really has paid off with me professionally and personally too. So that's one of the biggest reasons I enjoy going.
Packing and going to an alert conference, there are three critical items that you need to bring with you in order to be successful when you're there. You need to bring a notepad, a pen, and a stack of business cards. If you have those three things, you're going to be great, and you're going to take notes. You're going to go into class and you're going to listen to a speaker and you're going to take notes. When I went to Alert in Denver 2 years ago, it's exactly as you described, and the networking that, and the knowledge extends beyond the classroom. It transfers to dinner that night. It transfers to bumping into people in the hallway in between classes. It transfers all over the place. It's 24/7 from start to finish. And if you're lacking those three things when you go there, you're not grasping the entire experience as it's intended to be. And more to the point, John, where can people find out information about the conference, the classes that are being offered, registration fees, and the like.
Absolutely. So if they go to our website, which is alert, alert.org, at the top there's a list of things, home, training, research, media. There's a conference tab. If you click on that, it'll take you to our conference website, alertconference.org. It talks about how to register. It talks about the information, the schedule, who the speakers are, the topics they're going to be discussed. It's got everything. We're going to have vendor show. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on, so it's very jam-packed 4 days. I mean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, something that's going to be a little bit new this year is we have an architect that's going to come in and talk about the architectural design process and how to get, from his perspective, how to get security and or law enforcement personnel involved in that process so we can have smarter designed buildings that are from a security standpoint and not just from a fire suppression standpoint now, and try to integrate all those things that are happening into the design of our new buildings, and then how to retrofit some existing buildings. And we're looking at wound patterns and how mass casualty events can be, you know, handled best, you know, on scene, pre-hospital care, transport times, what happens in the ED and the ORs. I think I can talk about it. Our medical advanced skills course that we're offering for paramedic certified folks. We're going to do a blood transfusion lab. We're going to draw blood, type it, and put it back in, because this is the stuff that we're seeing is saving people on battlefields. This is starting to save people in cities across America that have whole blood programs. And we need to start knowing how to crack the code on pre-hospital care that's meaningful, that's going to keep them alive long enough for them to be transported to definitive care, which usually means surgical intervention, which usually means it's over an hour by the time they've been injured that we get them to that surgeon's table. So there's a lot that we have to learn on how to keep them alive long enough for the surgeon to save them. So it's all going to happen there.
Yeah, the sifting and sorting aspect and figuring out the prioritization of who needs to go first based on OR availability is huge for survivability of these types of events. It's massive. So
sure.
I think it's great. I love the conference. I'm slotted to go as long as Army funding doesn't dry up at the last minute. And I look forward to being there again with my stack of business cards, my pen, and my notepad. And if you see me there, you can challenge me. I guarantee you I'll have all three of those things on me at any given time. Outside of the conference, Alert offers programs that they can also – people can look at that website – and see what those courses are and how to touch those and get involved as far as that learning piece. All that is on that website as well.
Yes, sir. So under the training tab, if you click on that, there's a course catalog. It covers everything, the level one course, the integration course, active shooter incident management, our solo officer response, our medical advanced skills, civilian response and casualty care. So that's a relatively new course that we put together. It's the civilian response and the stop the bleed, train the trainer. It's 2 days. We take people from zero to hero at the end of 2 days and we teach them everything. They have to teach it back to us, but then they also have to set up and run some crawl, walk scenarios that they're going to go back and do in their communities when they're done with that course. We have everything that's listed in there. Because of COVID, everything kind of stopped for months. And so we've got an excess or a surplus of some grants that have held over so that we could go out there and train with them when we finally got back to going live and we're live again. So all that to say that if you put a training request in or a hosting request in, chances are we're going to get to you this year. There's a lot of requests that are coming in, but we have a lot of funding from last year and this year and some that's coming up for next year that we're going to be able to utilize. So we're going to be out there training a lot. We'll see you in the airports or on the road.
Well, I'm definitely going to keep an eye out. There's some courses that I've flipped through on Alert's website over the last couple of years that I definitely want to be a part of. So when you come to South Carolina, I'm going to figure out a way to get in to see you anyway. So I think we are getting right close to the witching hour. I always try to keep the talk to about an hour. I don't like to monopolize time much more beyond that. So as we wrap it up, I'd like to give Captain DiLorenzo any alibis, anything you want to push out there. The floor is yours as you see fit, sir.
Just thank you for the opportunity to talk about this really important topic, one that I'm very, very passionate about. You know, hats off to Alert for putting together the summit that is gotten the ball started for this recovery program that is in its infancy but being developed. If I can ever be of any assistance to anyone that's listening professionally, please reach out to me at the city of Myrtle Beach. I'm happy to help, give any expertise, any guidance I can. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's a lot of work is already being done and already there. So if you're struggling, please reach out and we can get you any help that you need.
Excellent. And you have a profile on LinkedIn. So if you want to reach out in a more personal way and not go through a department, I'm sure people can reach out to you on that public platform as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And John, looking forward to the conference, looking forward to what Alert is going to be doing as it ebbs and flows in its traditional proactive manner to dealing with these unfortunate but very real threats that we face amongst us responders. And is there anything else you'd like to add or anything you'd like to throw out there real quick before we wrap it up?
No, just my appreciation for you and for everybody that makes this happen, for Captain, for being on here. It's great to hear from you again. Look forward to seeing you guys in a few weeks. And most importantly, my deepest, most sincere appreciation for everybody that's out there doing the job when it's not easy, and it is not easy. Probably the hardest it's been in a long, long, long time right now. But, Winston Churchill once said, sometimes doing your best isn't good enough. Sometimes you have to do what's required. And even when it doesn't seem like anybody else gets it, we know what's required. We know what the right thing is to do. That's who we are. And you just see it still day after day after day. We're out there doing it. So, I mean, God bless you, and my hat's off to you. And hopefully we'll see you in a few weeks, and I can thank you in person.
Well, I will make every effort to be there, and thank you very much. I have very little that I could possibly ever follow up with both of those. So I appreciate everybody tuning in to Scenes of Violence. We'll see you again in about 6 weeks. God bless. Be safe. Lift each other up. Take care of one another. Stay low. And as always, continue to be a student of this profession or whatever other profession that you are in. Got to stay learning. Otherwise, you're going to be irrelevant. Thank you very much. I appreciate you. God bless, and have a good night.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.